Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 178, we review the July 2019 issue of Retinal Physician, focusing on ocular oncology, with our ocular oncology colleague, Dr. Basil Williams, joining us, along with Dr. Ajay Kurian. Plus, we humor ourselves by discussing NBA free agency starting today on July 1st. As always, all articles discussed can be found at retinalphysician.com. A list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. There is also a link in the episode description that if you click on it, you can claim CME credits via the AAO website. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be back to preview the July-August issue of Retinal Physician, found at retinalphysician.com. And this issue is specially focused on ocular oncology. Two correspondents join me now. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Ajay Kurian from University of Rochester. Ajay, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Ajay, if it was just you and I, it would probably be very difficult, but that's why we recruited an ocular oncologist to join us. So joining us for the first time on the program, Dr. Basil Williams, a vitreoretinal surgeon, ocular oncologist at Cincinnati Eye Institute and affiliated with the University of Cincinnati. Basil, welcome.
What's going on, Jay? Thanks for the invite.
No problem. We are going to go through a few articles. Again, these articles, you can read them online on the website. We're not necessarily here to just summarize what's there, but just use this as a jumping off point for discussion. And honestly, I don't think Ajay and I consider ourselves experts on anything. One thing we're not experts on is ocular oncology. So I'm glad we have Basil here so we can just pepper him with questions that we might find interesting. So Ajay, I'm going to just briefly summarize the first article we're going to discuss, which is called Diagnostic Biopsy of Intraocular Tumors, Subtitles, Techniques, Specimen Handling, and Complications. This was by Valenzuela et al. With Arun Singh from Cleveland Clinic as the senior author. And just to briefly summarize, they go through different biopsy techniques that they recommend for different parts of the eye, such as the iris, the ciliary body, the choroid, the vitreous, and handling these specimens how to make sure that your pathology is correct and how to make sure that you are getting what you need read. And for most of us who are not pathologists, at least to let your pathologist know what to do and how to make that job easier for them. And they kind of go through also, again, the what the pathology does look like for melanocytic and non-melanocytic tumors of the eye. And then complications of these biopsy techniques. So let's start with the basics. And Ajay, you can chime in, and I'm going to ask Basil. So the first thing, if you are a retina specialist, and let's start with solid tumors because they are different. If you suspect a melanoma, for example, of the choroid, what is the preferred biopsy technique for most ocular oncologists at this point? And if there isn't a preferred one for every situation, what sort of determines, for example, if you do a transscleral biopsy versus a transvitreal biopsy?
Yeah, so I think there's a few factors to begin with first. So you want to assess why you're doing the biopsy. If you're pretty sure clinically that this is a choroidal melanoma, then you don't necessarily need to do a biopsy for histopathological confirmation. There are some practices that do that regularly, but most often people are doing biopsies at this time point if you're sure that it's a choroidal melanoma clinically. They're doing it for prognostic testing, so whether it be for gene expression profiling or for DNA testing. And so that changes a little bit how much sample you need to get and things like that. Because if you're doing it for prognostic testing alone, then those tests are pretty reliable with a fairly small sample. In any event, when you decide that you're going to do this biopsy, now the location of the lesion also matters. So if you have a posterior segment lesion, so if this is a choroidal melanoma that's kind of posterior to the equator, it would be really challenging to do a transscleral biopsy. Because the amount of manipulation of the eye required to get to that location, even to transilluminate to identify the area in order to do the transscleral biopsy would be really difficult. So in the vast majority of those, if you're doing a fine needle aspiration biopsy, you'd be doing a pars plana approach. And if you're doing that with the indirect and the needle, I think a lot of people are using a 27 gauge long, some people are using a 25, and some people may go as low as a 23. And so you'll go in, and obviously everything will be upside down and backwards, so it takes a little bit of getting used to doing this procedure. There are obviously a number of people who are vitreoretinal trained who will do this with a trocar or a trocar and an infusion and actually do it with the cutter or use the trocar to do the needle and do that through the scope. So it eliminates the inversion aspect of things. I don't think that there is necessarily a preferred or a right way to do it. I think it depends on your training, comfort, and experience. And all of those techniques work really, really well. So it just matters which one's the best in your hands.
Ajay, you know, and you can add your comments. One of the things I'm going to just say early on, I kind of mentioned, and I think we're probably both spoiled, and all of us may be spoiled because we spent time in academic departments where we have access to ocular oncologists. And I do think there are people out in practice doing retina in areas where patients maybe don't have access to an ocular oncologist close by. So there are a lot of retina people out there doing oncology type procedures, which, you know, everyone has their preferences. I usually don't do unless I'm working in conjunction with somebody. And Ajay, you can comment if that's true in your case as well. But let's talk a little bit about avoiding, I think one of the concerns we'd all have, Basil, is tumor spread, right? So like, if I'm doing a biopsy, what I don't want to do is cause a malignant tumor to spread, especially a malignant tumor that could potentially be fatal and not just lose the eye. So what sort of things do people do? And I know, again, it's controversial to limit that.
So again, I think it's really important before you do the biopsy to think what are the possible lesion types that you're dealing with. If you're dealing with a melanocytic tumor, you can be a little bit more comfortable that using safe practices, you're likely to limit extraocular spread. There have obviously been a few reports of extraocular spread associated with biopsy, but they are pretty rare. So if you're doing a transscleral biopsy, that means you're basically going directly into tumor tissue. So you're going to do your transillumination to highlight the area where you want to biopsy. And if you're going directly into tumor tissue, you really want to try to perform cryotherapy to that site as you come out. So if there are any cells that are coming with you, the cryotherapy at the release of the freeze should destroy those cells. Now, a lot of people have variations in techniques in terms of how they do this. Some people just go directly beveled into the sclera. Some people do a little cut down to create a pouch there. So that way, when the needle goes through, it's only going partial thickness through the sclera, and then that that outer area can be closed with a suture. So I think as far as transscleral, that's mostly how people try to protect themselves. If you're going through the pars plana approach, a lot of people tend to feel that you don't necessarily need to do cryotherapy in those areas because you're not going, the tumor, as you leave the eye, you're not bringing the tumor directly with you, although the cells do potentially leave through that needle track. So I think whether or not you do cryotherapy in that setting, that tends to be a little bit more controversial with a lot of people choosing not to. If you're going through a vitrectomy approach or using a trocar approach, I think people do tend to cryo the site of the trocar as the trocar comes out. So oftentimes people will do a little bit of a conge cut down in that area so that you have bare sclera exposed. And when you remove the trocar, you do your cryotherapy directly to the sclera in that area so that whatever cells may potentially be coming out doesn't get stuck in the subconjunctival space if you haven't done a localized pteridomy, and then doesn't get stuck kind of transscleral, because at least the cryotherapy would treat that area.
You know, Ajay, one of the things that as retina specialists who don't do oncology that we still may encounter frequently are patients that have suspicion for primary vitreoretinal lymphoma. What sort of case presentation makes you suspicious for PVRL? And then maybe you can throw it to Basil to see, you know, what sort of things, again, can be done to maximize yield from those specimens?
So when you're thinking about PVRL, there's a few things that you want to pay attention to. So obviously, any older patient who's having vitreous floaters, you want to keep that in the back of your mind. Definitely, if you see kind of yellowish subretinal deposits on your clinical exam, and if you get an OCT through that area and you see the sub-RPE deposits, those kind of things are more of a giveaway that you're thinking of primary vitreoretinal lymphoma. I think the most important part of this process is having it in the back of your mind that this is what the diagnosis may be, and then speaking with your pathologist to let them know ahead of time. Knowing your department and knowing your pathology department and your lab really is helpful, because you can know what tests are available and how the specimen needs to be sent. So if you're doing a vitrectomy, for instance, for a primary vitreoretinal lymphoma, you want to try and get a non-dilute sample in the beginning, and you want to try and get as much as you can, and you can split that in half. And you can send some of that directly to pathology fresh, and some of that can go for flow cytometry. If you can get more sample, and this is really always a challenge, there's obviously some other things you can do. Look at the IL-10:6 ratio. You can try and check MYD88, but not every lab does this. And because the MYD88 is often tested on other bodily tissues, they usually require a large sample size in order to be able to actually analyze the specimen. So a lot of places are requiring at least 1 milliliter, sometimes more than 2 milliliters. So sometimes that can be a little bit of a challenge. But having that communication with the pathologist and with the lab beforehand is extremely important, so that they can get the tissue and kind of work on things right away. So this is definitely one of the cases that would try to avoid doing after hours, or if you don't have kind of the full team and support around.
Basil, do you have an ocular pathologist, or do you work with the general pathology team, or is there somebody in the general pathology team who specializes in eyes?
Yeah, so we have a general pathologist who specializes in ocular pathology. During his training, he ended up doing a lot of cases with eyes, so he feels pretty comfortable with it. Now, when it comes to lymphoma, kind of the heme path team also plays a role, and so they all kind of combine to work on the vitreoretinal lymphoma cases. But in general, most of our cases are read by one pathologist who has a lot of exposure to ocular pathology.
Switching gears, finishing up with the oncology portion, there was an article talking about intravitreal chemotherapy by Elaine Binkley that kind of went through the different things that are used intravitreally, including bevacizumab, methotrexate, rituximab, and topotecan. Just to summarize, Basil, and again, I know ocular oncology can be very controversial and different things are done. And one of the things, melphalan, of course, which I didn't mention, sorry, in that list. There's a lot of controversy about what people do. But general rules, again, in terms of when these intravitreal agents are used. So one of the things they talked about was in the adult population, you may see more use of bevacizumab, methotrexate, rituximab. Pediatric population for retinoblastoma, melphalan or topotecan. What sort of scenarios, let's just talk about RB. What sort of scenarios is intravitreal chemotherapy done in kids versus intraarterial or other sorts of treatments that may be done for retinoblastoma?
Right. So I think in general, at least historically, intravitreal chemotherapy is reserved for situations in which there is vitreous seeding. Because we know that systemic chemotherapy and intraarterial chemotherapy can work in those cases, but a lot of the treatment failures that we've had in the past with those two techniques are due to seeding in the vitreous. And you can get good intravitreal concentration of the chemotherapy sometimes with systemic administration, but a lot of times you don't get it to the level that you need. So administering intravitreal, whether it be melphalan or topotecan, can reduce the tumor load and is actually quite successful at decreasing or eliminating the tumor burden in the vitreous. Now, there's been different regimens used in terms of doses for melphalan, usually ranging between 20 and 30 micrograms. How frequently the injections are done varies a little bit from center to center. And varying levels of toxicity have been reported when it comes to that. That being said, more recently, I think people are seeing that intravitreal chemotherapy can play a role in more cases than just intravitreal disease. So in some cases where you have either resistant or recurrent retinal tumors or subretinal seeding, intravitreal injections, intravitreal chemotherapy can actually be beneficial in improving the disease there. I should also say that it is extremely infrequent to use intravitreal chemotherapy alone. So it's pretty much used as an adjuvant therapy along with either systemic or intraarterial chemotherapy.
That's great. You know, Ajay, the next thing we're going to talk about is ocular tumor masquerade syndromes by Mary Arno and Ashvini Reddy. And they go through various things that can appear to be like uveitis, but may have it neoplastic origin. They talk about primary vitreoretinal lymphoma, the most famous masquerader, but also primary choroidal lymphoma, sclerochoroidal calcification, which is not a neoplastic condition, but can be confused. And then nodular posterior scleritis, which is an inflammatory condition, but oftentimes, again, is confused with some sort of solid tumor. So Ajay, when you're, again, seeing a masquerade syndrome in your hands, let's start with PV, you know, Basil went through kind of PIOL or PVRL. What's kind of the biggest things you look for? One of the things they talked about was making sure that you taper steroids before a biopsy. I mean, what when you're kind of seeing a patient, what would kind of give you that red light to go flashing in your head that, oh, even though I'm not an ocular oncologist, this may be something that needs an ocular oncologist?
I think some of the biggest things are the age of the patient. So certainly in an older patient, that's when I get a little bit more worried, or if I'm seeing that combination of the subretinal changes as well as the vitreous changes. I think those are sort of the things that really make me wonder. And also, if this has just been going on for a long time, just hasn't been seeming to get better and everything else is coming back negative. It's always something good to sort of keep in the back of your head. I think that's the best thing to have with all these masquerade syndromes, to just sort of keep it in the back of your head so it's something that you're thinking about, so that if something is just not responding the way that you expect it to respond, that you then start thinking about these other masqueraders, basically. Certainly the OCT, if you can get a good OCT and see those classic findings, that would be very helpful as well with the subretinal changes there.
You know, Basil, primary choroidal lymphoma is something that's less commonly seen. And I feel like when you're in training, you're doing differential diagnosis, an image conference or anything, it shows up in the differential. It's one of those things you just spout off as a resident or retina fellow. It's like, oh, lymphoma's on the differential. But differentiating it from inflammatory conditions, such as birdshot, for example, can be tricky as they went through. I mean, they both can happen in older patients. They both can have choroidal lesions, and they both can be steroid responsive. So what sort of things can help you differentiate someone with choroidal lymphoma? They talk a little bit about looking for ocular adnexal lymphoma, for example, in the eyelids. So go ahead.
Yeah, so I think they did a great job at highlighting looking for ocular adnexal changes. So any sort of salmon patches on the front surface of the eye can be extremely helpful. When you're doing an ultrasound, as they also mentioned, choroidal lymphoma can have extraocular components or can be associated with extraocular components. So if you see a lesion that's hypoechoic posterior to the globe, that can be a tip-off sign. One of the things that I also learned is when you have choroidal lymphoma, it can actually really disguise the choroidal vessel. So especially if you have a person who seems to have kind of lightish pigmentation to their eyes, but for whatever reason, if you look at the other eye and then that eye, you realize in the other eye, you can see the choroidal vessels really well, but you can't in the affected eye, then that's something that often goes along with choroidal lymphoma. Whereas in birdshot, a lot of times you can actually still see the choroidal vasculature very well. And then looking at OCT through the area of the lesion, choroidal lymphoma also often has kind of a very wavy appearance to it. Sometimes it's been mentioned as kind of a seasick formation. So it kind of is very, very irregular, very up and down in terms of the configuration on OCT. So I think all of those factors are pretty helpful.
Well, I'm definitely not as knowledgeable about any of this, but I'm going to switch to something that maybe none of us really have knowledge of, just a cool surgical technique that was described, which was surgical technique with fibrin glue for optic disc maculopathy, and they subtitled an alternative that could aid in preserving retinal tissues by David Almeida and authors. And they talked about optic nerve pits, and this is essentially a technique where you actually use fibrin glue to treat patients who may have an optic pit associated serous detachment with vision loss by doing a vitrectomy and putting fibrin glue over the optic nerve and then doing a fluid air exchange. And they go through some pearls about getting the Hylid up, making sure there's no remnants of the pit, and, you know, making sure that the strand that's attached to the pit is completely removed, and then, you know, the Tassil has to go on the pit. Ajay, I'll let you start. I've never done this. I've seen this described at meetings. These cases can be really, really challenging. What's your standard approach? So if you do see a patient with an optic nerve pit that is symptomatic with subretinal fluid that, let's say, doesn't improve with observation, what sort of things do you discuss with them? Let's say they're a younger patient. Let's say they're 25 or 30, phakic. What sort of discussion do you have, and what sort of options present, and what would you like to do first if you had all options available?
So I certainly haven't had too much experience with optic pits surgically. I've seen a few, but fortunately they have done pretty well vision-wise just with observation. I do always talk to them about the possibility that if things do get worse or they become more symptomatic, that we might need to do surgery, and including a vitrectomy. I think that this the approach that Dr. Almeida is talking about is pretty interesting. I've never seen the glue being placed in. I know there's a bunch of different options that you could work on with sometimes putting in a little bit of blood. I know Layla has spoken about that in the past, but I think overall these are a little bit of a more difficult surgery with more variable outcomes. And so I think just stressing that is important when you're counseling the patient about any sort of intervention.
Basil, any thoughts?
I don't have much to add. I don't necessarily have a lot of experience surgically with this, and I think these cases are fairly few and far between. It definitely is an interesting technique, and I would be potentially interested in trying it, but not much else to add.
You know, the only thing I worry about, and this is probably irrelevant because the glue becomes solid so quickly. You remember, like, these optic nerve pit cases where people put oil and then you do an MRI, or they have the reports of MRIs, and you see the oil in the ventricles. Mm-hmm. I mean, doesn't that, I always worry, I know that the glue is probably not going to go, but there's always this concern that it's communicating, this debate whether the fluid comes from the vitreous or from the cerebrospinal fluid, but if it is communicating, I just wonder, it probably doesn't do anything, such a small amount, if that glue is floating around somewhere in someone's ventricle after you do this. And there's no way to know. I mean, I guess in a lab, you could create a model and tag it and then look. But again, it probably seals so quickly, it's irrelevant. But I always wonder about doing anything around the hole.
Right. I think in addition to the speed at which the glue dries, I think there is a component of when we're injecting the oil, we're often injecting it at such a high rate that there's so much pressure involved in the injection, especially as the oil fills the eye more, that may be related in some ways to the oil kind of being pushed through that area. And so, you know, if the eye is kind of normal tensive, then I think the Tassil would be less likely to do that, although obviously that's just a theoretical consideration. So
that's a great point.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think you do have more faith in oil than I do. I use oil very frequently for many reasons, but there's one thing I've learned is that oil gets wherever it wants to go. So maybe you're right. Maybe you can reduce the risk of it pushing through at the time if you drop the pressure. But I feel like the oil is going to emulsify at some point and find its way anyway. I mean, at some point, if it wants to go there, it will. Like, I mean, they've done studies, you take a pathologic specimen out with oil, you look everywhere. The oil gets literally everywhere. It's like, I don't know. It's like the house guest that uses every room in your house. Like, it's pretty incredible. But yeah, that is a good point. And I wonder, again, like you said, if you keep the pressure low when you're putting the oil in, maybe that does help in kind of reducing influx or preventing influx of the oil through the hole.
I mean, at least initially. But like you said, when the oil is there for a long period of time, there's not much that you can do about that.
Well, guys, I really appreciate Basil especially. Really appreciate, Ajay, I appreciate it too. But I appreciate Basil right now because... ocular oncology part was very, very helpful, and our listeners, most of whom are not ocular oncologists, really benefit from that.
Yeah, thank you. There's one other point I wanted to make, which they did point out or highlight in a couple of the articles, and it was to be wary of biopsying in situations in which retinoblastoma may be there. And so I think the classic thought is, well, if you have somebody that's kind of over 5 or 6 years old, or maybe over 10 or kind of in the adult population, That's not something that you have to think about anymore. There are situations, though, in which retinoblastoma can present in the later teen or adult population years. And so if you have a mass that you can identify, it's not melanocytic, keep in mind when you're doing your ultrasound to potentially look for calcifications, because I have seen a couple of cases of adults presenting with retinoblastoma for the first time, one of which I saw undergo a biopsy, and I think everyone was kind of shocked to realize that it was retinoblastoma. The patient ended up doing very well. But again, it's something to keep in the back of your mind if you're doing a biopsy for a lesion that you're not quite sure what it is, and there's even the faintest possibility that it might be retinoblastoma. Try and use all precautions when doing the biopsy. So definitely cryo with the site and be extra careful about preventing extraocular spread. That's the last point I wanted to make.
That is probably the best public service announcement we've ever had. That is an excellent, excellent, excellent point. Patients don't read the book. They can present. You've seen probably more. I've heard of cases of young adults, teenagers, and again, there's a biopsy done and patient has retinoblastoma. So I think that's a really valid point. So thanks for that, Basil. I'm super excited for the second half of our podcast because I've been super restrained. We've done podcasts for months now. We haven't talked about basketball in a long time because I think that, you know, with the playoffs going on, the episodes probably weren't going to release in a timely enough fashion to be interesting. And again, there's probably very few people who are actually listening and don't turn it off at this point. But we're going to humor ourselves and talk about it. So, and we're going to be organized about this, guys. So, a couple things. So, it's NBA free agency. This episode will drop July 1st. So, we're going to have all these predictions that come out, and they're going to come out the day that free agency starts. And maybe things will leak before that of under the table agreement. So, start with the first thing. So, the biggest trade news was that Anthony Davis was traded to the Los Angeles Lakers for a boatload of draft picks. Alonzo Ball, Brandon Ingram, Josh Hart, a lot of young assets for Anthony Davis. They've got Anthony Davis and LeBron James. So Basil, you're Rob Pelinka right now. If you're in a vacuum, what is your wish list? You're not going to get Kawhi Leonard, let's say. No Kawhi. But you can do, you have like whatever, $26 million in cap space. You have, they're planning to dump the rest of their players besides those two and Kuzma. So they have 9 roster slots to fill. How are you filling out those slots?
Right. So, first of all, I think that it's a good thing for them that they were able to land Anthony Davis at obviously a very steep price. In order to fill out the roster, I probably would want to surround those guys with as good a team as possible, try and get some good shooters and some good defenders. I think it would be detrimental to the team in most situations to try to get another superstar, especially if that superstar did not both shoot very well and defend very well. And I think Kawhi Leonard's probably the only person in that situation in the current free agent class. So barring somebody like him, I think you're looking at people, hopefully looking at people like Patrick Beverley, Danny Green, perhaps Brooke Lopez, that you can try and find in the $10 to $12 million range, who are going to hit open shots, play extremely hard on defense, and then support the main two players as much as possible. I am not convinced at the Lakers' managerial abilities to pull that off, but we'll see.
You know, Ajay, the Knicks traded Kristaps Porzingis to open up max cap space for basically nothing. You know, they basically did it as a contract dump, and they didn't win the lottery. They got the third pick, and now they were going to sign Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant tears his Achilles on like the last day of the season. He's gone for the whole year. What do the Knicks do right now? And maybe let's flip it around because Knicks fans always think the opposite way. What do you not want them to do?
So I definitely don't want them to go for like tier two free agents and max them out. We've been that road before when we signed Amari.
So no Kemba Walker max.
You know, I think that we would be stuck somewhere in like the middle of the pack if we were to get Kemba Walker. I think he would make us better. I just don't think he would get us to where we would want to be in terms of being able to actually compete for a championship unless a lot of our young players actually mature and do a lot better. But I think that ideally I'd like to do like what the Sixers did, where they absorbed some bad contracts and got a lot of assets with it. And that just really helped set them up for where they are right now. They were able to turn those around and really help build the team. So hopefully they'll go that route at this point, since we do have a pretty solid number of young players, instead of going for some players who are not worth those max contracts at this point and getting us tied up for the future.
Ajay, the Sixers were bad on purpose for like 5 years in a row.
I know. I mean, we've been bad not on purpose for 5 years in a row. So
but you have to have intent. Without intent, there's never any execution in life. You have to have intent. But the new lottery odds also don't help, right, Basil? Like, so like you're a Knicks fan. Like, what do you do? Like, do you just keep waiting?
Yeah, so I think it's a tough situation. The ideal scenario, which I don't think is possible, and I obviously, you know, Kevin Durant getting injured is a bad thing for him and his career and for the NBA, and it's also kind of a tough situation for the Knicks.
Yeah.
So, if I'm the Knicks, I still try and find Kevin Durant to a max contract, hope that he's interested in coming, let him recover for a full season, draft RJ Barrett. The Knicks will still be fairly bad. And then at least next year, they can get hopefully a reasonable draft pick. And then when Kevin Durant comes back healthy, they will have RJ Barrett, hopefully a better developed Kevin Knox, a new draft pick, and then perhaps they can pick up another free agent at that time. But I think, you know, like Ajay said, try very hard to avoid overpaying someone for a big contract just because they have the money to do so.
Well, Daryl Morey apparently today was trying to talk them into taking Chris Paul's contract and like four draft picks or something to get rid of it. Because
yeah, I don't even think the Knicks are dumb enough to take that.
No, they said no.
They said no.
He should have gone to the Lakers first, but they have no assets left because they traded all their picks to New Orleans. Oh, man. Well, okay, let's talk about injuries, man. I don't want to talk about injuries too long, but injuries are super depressing. I was texting you guys those nights, and, you know, I really liked the... I did not love Durant signing with the Warriors, but I really like Kevin. I think Kevin Durant's an amazing basketball player, and I think he's fun to watch. And I thought the Warriors, when they're playing Bell, are just maybe the most fun team to watch I've seen, except maybe the Nash Suns. Like, they're just a really, really good team to watch. And Klay Thompson tearing his ACL the next day, and it's just, like, totally, like, injuries happen, though. And we talked about that. And Basil, you brought that up. You said, look, injuries always happen, and they kind of fade away. These are probably the most dramatic examples. Maybe the most high-profile star to be hurt on that stage. But we've seen playoffs affected by injuries before. So I started going back and thinking about it. And, you know, here's some bad ones. I'll give you some candidates. You know, Ewing, you know, he got hurt in the playoffs in 99, the year the Knicks made the finals, you know. And they didn't have him, and they got destroyed by the Spurs in the final. Maybe he makes a difference. You know, Chris Webber, everyone remembers 2002 for the Kings, but the Kings were really good the next year. And the league was not that strong. The Nets were NBA finalists, not that good. The Spurs team that won was probably the weakest Duncan team that won. I'm not even sure who their second best player was. That was a not great team. And the Mavericks were not ready yet. And the Kings lost them because Weber tore out his knee and he was never the same. And that's a pretty bad injury. Russell Westbrook, no one remembers this, but again, the Thunder got to the finals in 2012. The next year, they were the number one seed in the West. And then he went to call a timeout in the first round of playoffs, and Patrick Beverley whacked his knee, and he tore his meniscus. Yeah, and then he was gone for the playoffs, and Durant pulled them through that series, but then they lost to the Grizzlies, and that was weird because the Grizzlies were definitely not good enough to make the conference finals, and they got swept by the Spurs, and it should have really been Thunder Spurs 4 years in a row. I mean, 3 years in a row. It should have been 2012, 13, 14. And maybe the Thunder win the finals that year. Maybe they're ready. And that obviously changes a lot of things. You know, maybe the James Harden trade, which everyone makes fun of, it was still bad, but they were still the top seed without Harden. They were still there, and they had home court throughout the playoffs. Or maybe not throughout the playoffs, and the Heat were better that year. And then, you know, again, I don't love the Cavs, but Kyrie and Kevin Love, they got hurt in 2015. You know, never remembers that Cavs team being dragged to the finals. Everyone says, well, the Cavs never had a chance. But, you know, the Warriors weren't impenetrable that year. They were beatable. So, and again, maybe you guys are biased because you're a Knicks fan. I mean, what is this? Are this still the two worst injuries you've seen that a team has had to suffer at this stage? Are there things that are worse? And we didn't even mention like Chris Paul pulling his hamstring last year, which isn't as devastating to his career, but or 2 years ago, excuse me. Or it was last year. Yes. Basil, what do you think? I mean, what's kind of the worst injury you remember in terms of impact at the moment to a team's chances?
Yeah, so, well, my first real basketball memory was the one that had the biggest impact on me, and I think it was the 88 finals when Isaiah Thomas hurt his ankle against the Lakers.
Oh, that's
and,
a good one.
He went on that crazy run in the third quarter. He's hitting every shot, but he just couldn't do it. He was too injured, and they ended up losing as a result. And then, you know, earlier in the playoffs, Kawhi got hurt on that dirty Zaza Pachulia play, and I think the Spurs probably would have lost then anyway, but it would have been an interesting series. You know, as you mentioned, there's been a bunch of injuries to big players in big moments, but I think these are probably the two most famous players with also very, very serious injuries at this stage. I'm not sure there's ever been anything like this. For somebody to tear their Achilles one game, you know, a top two or three player in the league to tear their Achilles, and then another top tier player to tear their ACL in the very next game, you know, it's pretty much unheard of and devastating for those guys and for the game of basketball, unfortunately.
I think we've talked about this before. We've talked about this before. You know, the Warriors were basically built so that if any one person goes down, they're still able to dominate. Unfortunately, two people went down, and Kawhi Leonard was playing like a beast, and it just didn't work out for them. But I think just that back-to-back injury for those two key players, that's not something that I remember happening before.
I mean, there's always what-ifs, but you know what's the crazy thing? You know, the Raptors looked like they were going to win in Game 5 if they just win that game. Klay Thompson doesn't tear. I mean, you can do what ifs with everything. Like Klay Thompson doesn't tear his ACL. Like, I've watched that play like 3 or 4 times on replay. And the one thing that's interesting, he was on a total roll. Like, he was killing it too. Both of them were playing really well at the time they got hurt, which was really sad. But the replay, it's a fast break. There's a turnover. Lowry falls down, and they're running on the fast break, and they have Klay Thompson ahead of the pack. And normally he just flares out to the corner and shoots a three, and he was open for that. But he cut towards the basket to get the pass, which is like the classic old thing. Now everyone just runs to the corners, which is sometimes good and sometimes dumb. But he went to the basket, and that's just the thing. You know, this happens. Like, you take a hit, you fall weirdly, and next thing you know, your career and your season. And, you know, I hope he comes back. He was awesome in that game, and he's one of my favorite players. I think he's super underrated for what he's able to do. I think that he's never going to be a great individual one-on-one scorer, but he could easily be the second best player in a championship team. I mean, he has been, I guess. Like, it depends who you think.
He already was.
You know?
I agree with you. I actually think that he could be a pretty good one-on-one offensive player in a different team. I think it's probably better for him not to be, because that means somebody else is a little bit more ball dominant. And I think, you know, he's probably one of everyone's favorite players. I think he's one of those guys that, even if you dislike the Warriors, there's not a lot of people saying bad things about him. And so I wish him a speedy recovery. Thankfully, with today's technology, people who tear ACLs tend to return and recover pretty well. The Achilles injury, on the other hand, that tends to be quite a different story.
You know, the other injury we didn't talk about, which is but I was thinking about ACLs, of Derrick Rose, you know, that was a bad one. And it was the first, I think it was game one or game two of the playoffs, but they were also the number one seed. And everyone thinks of those Heat teams as being super dominant and winning everything. But that Heat team scuffled, man. I remember that Heat team really struggled with Indiana and really struggled with Boston. And there was just no guarantees. But yeah, ACLs are tough to come back from. I think he'll come back hopefully strong. You know, we're going to have two more questions, and I'll let you guys go. So first question is, and this is a very random question because I went down the rabbit hole looking at these injuries. Who is better, Chris Webber or Chris Bosh? Ajay?
That's a tough question. I think Chris Bosh has certainly achieved more when it comes to championships and in some ways knowing what his ideal role is. But I think as a single individual player, I think Chris Bosh, I'd probably rank him higher in terms of just what he was able to do with his teams alone without more help.
How about you, Basil?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. You know, I think their careers have been shaped by injuries very differently. You know, Chris Bosh had the small abdominal strain in the playoffs, but otherwise recovered. And so I think he ended up benefiting from the quality of his teammates. And then his career was cut short by an injury, whereas Chris Webber got injured kind of midway through his career, completely changed his game. And he went from being a completely dominant scorer to a very good scorer, but also a very good passer and a willing passer. So I think maybe career-wise, Chris Bosh will look better. I think probably the better or more talented player from like a raw talent standpoint was probably Chris Webber. And if he would have gotten injured later in his career, kind of the same time frame that Bosh did, I think maybe he would be viewed as more talented, even if not more successful.
Yeah, it's sad because you probably imagine both of them had games that you would... This is what people drive me crazy because they're always talking about people who have games that age well. And I think that there are certain types of games that can age well. Like Klay Thompson should age well, or Kevin Durant should age well. But aging just doesn't account for injuries, you know? Like, if you get hurt and you lose enough speed, you just become someone you can't play the same way. And Bosh, obviously, it's a different sort of medical issue, like you said. Here's my weird stat about them because I looked at this. Bosh made 11 straight All-Star teams. Webber only made 5. But Bosh only made All-NBA once. He made All-NBA second team just one time, and that was it. Webber made All-NBA 5 or 6, 5 different times. He made first team once, second team 3 times, and third team once. Very, very weird. So, like, that's telling you what maybe what Basil was referring to, the consistency maybe for Bosh, Webber kind of the higher peak.
I think that's probably the best way to describe it, Webber with the higher peak. And Bosh has been on some great teams, and I think appropriately so. They reward winning by all-star appearances. And that being said, I mean, you know, Bosh had to sacrifice a lot during those Miami years in order to let LeBron and Dwayne Wade shine. So he sacrificed in shot attempts and therefore in points. He sacrificed in rebounds. He sacrificed in terms of being the emotional scapegoat a lot of the time for the team.
He was, so, I mean, we were all there. I mean, he was definitely the one who had to adjust the most. I mean, there was no question. I mean, I feel like LeBron and Wade adjusted. They basically just took turns playing the same way. Maybe LeBron was more of a facilitator at times. But, you know, Bosh, I always think of him, he was never as good a playmaker, like pushing on the fast break like Draymond Green. But he was kind of the first successful small ball five. Like, because he was really good defensively for that team. He would trap, he would come out, he could switch pretty well. And people don't really talk about that. Okay, here's the most important question, because this came out today. Space Jam 2, players have been announced. I don't know if you guys saw this. So the players are going to be, besides LeBron, Damian Lillard, Anthony Davis, Klay Thompson. I guess they didn't know he would have one knee, but Klay Thompson. And Chris Paul. So the question is,
that's
do
only
you take,
four people.
What do I have? James, Davis, Lillard. Damian Lillard, Klay Thompson, and Chris
Paul. Oh, Lillard. Okay. Got it.
So here's the question. Do you take Space Jam Team 1 or Space Jam Team 2 if they play?
I'm going to take Space Jam Team 1 because they have Michael Jordan.
That's it? That's your reasoning? I would agree. Yeah. That's my reasoning too. But I think also Team 1 had Charles Barkley. And Larry Johnson before he hurt his back.
And Patrick Ewing.
And then they have Sean Bradley and Muggsy Bogues, which is just comical. I don't know. I think that Sean Bradley and Muggsy become unplayable. They don't have five guys to play. How are they going to survive?
Michael Jordan will figure out a way. I'm not concerned.
I think Chris Paul would eventually kill LeBron James because he wouldn't pass him the ball enough because LeBron's a better playmaker.
The Lakers, maybe we'll find out.
Did you guys read that article that came out about the fight, like the infighting, like how Chris Paul came back from injury and he was like, "Hey guys, I'm back. So like, are we gonna run an offense?" Like, no, we're just gonna give it to James and get out of the way. You spot up over there. And he's like, "Wait, what?" And so apparently he was giving Harden feedback and after the game. He's like, "Yo, man," I'm sure he wasn't saying this nicely. He was like, "Yo, man, like when you pass me the ball, maybe it'd be better if you like actually spot up instead of just walking around." And Harden was like, "Don't tell me how to play basketball. You don't know I'm better than you." Oh, man.
James Harden plays like Randy Moss. If it's not
yes,
his play,
agreed.
It kind of like goes through the motions.
But this has been talked about. There was a great, you know, Zach Lowe writes these great articles. There's a great stat which talks about which players run the least when they don't have the ball. And I think the winner, like many years straight, was John Wall, and he doesn't run anymore when he doesn't have the ball because he doesn't play anymore. But Russell Westbrook's also really bad at this. And James Harden's bad. The thing is, James Harden's actually a good shooter. Like, you could definitely like run him off ball, whatever, but he like can't take a three unless he's taking a four-step travel backwards and falling into the person. Like, I'm a Rockets fan. I've been a Rockets fan before. I was a Heat fan as a kid, and I just can't stand watching James Harden. I know he's really good. I respect him completely. Maybe I don't respect him completely, but I respect the fact that he's good. But this is completely unsurprising that Chris Paul and him have beef, and it's just really funny because it I don't know. Their offense is despicable. Like, anyone who compares it to what D'Antoni ran in Phoenix, like, that was completely different.
Yeah, I can't imagine that D'Antoni is actually happy watching the product that's on the court. And I love Chris Paul. I've always loved him. He's obviously getting to a different stage in his career.
He's washed. He's that's what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a very annoying. He was a very annoying player to play with when he was at his peak, but he was so good it was hard to say anything to him. And now it wears on people a little bit more for him to be not as talented as he used to be, but at the same time still kind of demanding so much from everyone else.
He's had a weird career, man. He's had multiple missed opportunities if things broke one way or the other. Like, that New Orleans team could have beaten the Spurs that one year. They didn't. And then, like, he tore his knee. He kind of changed how he played. The Clippers just, like, they had injury problems, but they also blew so many chances when they could have and should have won. Like, I don't know. He's the next Knick, though, Ajay. I'm calling it. The Knicks are doomed to sign. Whoever the Knicks acquire is going to be done. It's going to be like that whole run of players they got in the 90s or like late early 2000s where they're like, oh, how about Penny Hardaway? Actually, he's done. How about Antonio McDyess? Oh, he tore his knee. He's also done. Oh, man. It's coming. Yeah. I really don't want Durant to sign
even
there.
Worse.
If Durant signs there, that's just a sign he's never going to come back.
Yeah. Honestly, now, the last like month has just shown what it's like to be a Knicks fan. You know, you have a terrible season, but you're like, at least we have the Zion draft, and then we get the third pick. And you're like, you know what? At least KD's coming to New York, and he tears his Achilles. It's there's nothing good that can happen. There should be some karma coming our way.
There really should. Well, I think RJ Barrett's going to be really good, barring... But, you know, Porzingis was really good. There was literally... I told you guys when this trade happened, there was literally no reason... I know what they were trying to do. It was dumb. It was so dumb. I know he didn't want to play there. You know what? There's been lots of stars who didn't want to play places who just end up being like, no, we're not going to trade you. Or you get a better haul. You let him play and show he's healthy, unless they don't think he's going to come back. But, oh, man, he's going to kill it this year, too. And it's going to be super sad for Knicks, not for him.
Yeah, unfortunately, it will be sad for the Knicks continually.
Yeah.
All right, guys. I'll let you guys go. Thank you so much for humoring me at the end. That was great. I don't think the listeners thought it was great, but I liked it. I'll listen to it later. I'll enjoy it. Yeah. Thank you for doing this. Basil, again, thanks for coming on for the first time. Ajay, thanks for corresponding. And enjoy the draft tomorrow and free agency.
All right. Take care, guys. Have a good night. Thanks.
Yeah. Take care. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 178 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category, as well as our blog, Equal Ground and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Remember, you can now claim CME credits for select podcasts via the AAO website. Log in as an AAO member and visit the link in the episode description. You can sign up for our mailing list on the website that gives you updates on the most recent episodes as they release. You can subscribe directly also on your mobile device, the Apple Podcast or Android Podcast Store, respectively. You can also like our Facebook page or find us on Twitter at Retina Podcast. To reach out to us, you can tweet at us, click on the contest link on our website, or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love, love, love feedback. Please let us know what we can do better and things we are already doing well. Many thanks to Dr. Williams and Dr. Kurian for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venencasa for preparing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
feeling?
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.